In one fundamental way, we could say that all of our practice comes down to the awareness of and purification of our motivation. There's one teaching from the Tibetan tradition that expresses this very simply, which says everything rests on the tip of motivation. So this becomes an essential and key point in our practice. In our Western cultures, it's interesting that we evaluate our actions based on their success or failure. An action is good if it's successful, it's not good if it's not successful. His Holiness the Dalai Lama suggested an entirely different way of evaluating the worth of our actions. He said that the true value of an act is not in its success or failure, but in the motivation behind it. Now that's a very different way of looking at our lives and what we do in the world. It seems obvious that there are so many aspects of our actions that we can control in terms of their results. No matter what we do, there's always going to be some level of praise and blame, some level of gain and loss, success or failure, things working out well, things working out easily. These are in the traditional Buddhist language called the eight vicissitudes of life, meaning the eight great worldly changes. Conditions keep changing. We can't control that. But we do have control. We are able to work on purifying the motivation behind our actions. And it's very interesting when we realign our sense of purpose and understanding so that the motivation becomes the most important consideration. Within the Buddhist teachings, there is one motivation that is talked about that is so vast and so skillful and so ennobling of our lives that it can become the reference point for our entire life journey. And this is called in the Buddhist teachings bodhicitta. Now bodhi is the Pali and Sanskrit word for awakening or awakened, enlightened. And citta is the word for heart or heart-mind. So bodhicitta, in its literal meaning, is the awakened heart, the awakened mind. But it generally refers more specifically to the motivation that we can develop and cultivate to free ourselves, to awaken ourselves in order to help awaken, liberate, enlighten all other beings. Now we all know that our practice will inevitably help others. As we become more peaceful, as we become more loving, all the people around us will benefit. So that's the natural consequence of the work we're doing. But it becomes a somewhat different matter when we put that motivation to awaken others, to free others, to work for the benefit of others, at the very front of our practice, not seeing it simply as the consequence, but when it actually becomes the motivation for our own practice. So when we begin to get a sense of that or a possibility of that, it's tremendously energizing. Although the teachings on bodhicitta, this motivation to awaken in order to help awaken all others, was more fully developed in the later schools of Buddhism, in Mahayana and Vajrayana, We find this same attitude of altruistic motivation throughout the earliest texts, the Pali texts. In one place it says, one sits with the mind set on one's own welfare, the welfare of others, and the welfare of both, even on the welfare of the whole world. So right in the text, it's just saying, it's reminding us of the attitude or the motivation that we can bring to every time we sit. With the mind set on one's own welfare, the welfare of others, the welfare of both, even the welfare of the whole world. And then again, in the Buddha's instructions to his first 60 disciples who had become fully enlightened, this was not long after he began teaching, he said to these 60 disciples, go forth, O bhikkhus, for the good of the many, the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the good benefit and happiness of people and devas. Let not two go by one way. Teach the Dharma, excellent in the beginning, excellent in the middle, excellent in the end. Proclaim the noble life, altogether perfect and pure. Work for the good of others, you who have done your duty. So from the very beginning of the teachings, there was this sense of practice being for the benefit of all. So we can understand to some extent bodhicitta and what it means on two levels. On one level, the relative level, relative bodhicitta, is compassion. On the ultimate level, ultimate bodhicitta refers to emptiness. And it's said that when both of these are present, compassion and the realization of emptiness, enlightenment is unavoidable. So given this guarantee of unavoidable enlightenment, it seemed a good idea to begin to explore these two levels of what they are in themselves, how they relate to each other, and how we can actually cultivate them and develop them in our own lives. Relative bodhicitta is compassion, and it manifests in the world as compassionate action. And it's called relative because it deals with the conventional level of beings, of self and other, of individuals. We send compassion to ourselves, to other beings, just as we do in the metta practice. It would be very odd to say, may the five aggregates of existence be happy. You know, because that's, when we're on the level of the aggregates, that's the more ultimate level. So on the relative level, we're dealing with our conventional way of being in the world. Ideas of self, ideas of other. And we develop compassion in that world. So what is this feeling? As you all know, compassion is that strong and deep wish, that strong and deep feeling that wants to alleviate the suffering of beings. That's the nature of compassion. To bring suffering to an end. Our own suffering and the suffering of others. Compassion opens us to the suffering that's there. And it overcomes our indifference. It overcomes our inaction. And so it is compassion. It is this feeling that moves us to act. Thich Nhat Hanh expressed this particularly well when he said, compassion is a verb. Right? Because the feeling of compassion implies the energy to do something. It was this very feeling of compassion, it said, that motivated the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, before his awakening, over the countless lifetimes it took for him to realize Buddhahood, full awakening of Buddhahood. I mean, think of the energy needed to accomplish that over so many lifetimes. What was the motivation for all that effort? It said that it was compassion for the suffering of beings, that aspiration of bodhicitta to awaken in order to awaken all others. The Dalai Lama said, compassion and love are precious things in life. They are not complicated. They are simple, but difficult to practice. And I think that's a very important realization. Compassion and love are precious things in life. They are not complicated. They are simple, but they're difficult to practice. So I think it's worth investigating why such beautiful and ennobling qualities should be difficult to practice. One would think that they would be easy to practice, but they're not. Compassion arises out of our willingness to come close to suffering. And the problem is that although we may want to be compassionate, and oftentimes are, still it's not always easy to open to the suffering that's present. Just as there are so many times when we don't like to open to our own suffering, to our own pain, we don't necessarily always want to open to the pain of others. Now, there are such strong tendencies in the mind that keep us defended or withdrawn or indifferent or apathetic in the face of suffering. And this indifference to the suffering that's there is often unacknowledged, and so becomes a hidden barrier to the development of compassion. So just as an experiment, you know, to begin to see and look at all this for yourselves, as an experiment, watch your mind and watch your reactions the next time you approach a situation of suffering. See what the mind does. It might be some pain in the body. How often do we feel some pain in the body and say, oh, good, let me open to this? We may come to that, but it's not so often that that's our first thought. What happens when some painful emotion arises? What's our response to it? Feelings of discontent, or fear, or shame, or unworthiness, or jealousy, or loneliness. There are a lot of difficult emotions that come in the course of our lives, in the course of a retreat. What's our response to it? What's our relationship to it? Do we have a willingness to open to that suffering, or do we pull back? Do we shrink back? Watch the mind when there's some interaction with a difficult person, either in person or here on retreat. Maybe it's just remembering a difficult interaction. The Dalai Lama, he often talks of this wonderful teaching by Shantideva, where he says that we should feel gratitude for our enemies, because our enemies teach us patience. How often does that even come to mind in the face of a conflict? And even if it comes to mind, as we might know, it's not so easy to practice in the midst of a conflict. Oh, thank you. You're helping me to develop patience. So we want to watch our minds. This will be an indication of our ability or our struggles to open to suffering with compassion when it arises. We just have to look at our own experience. It might be watching our response to situations of suffering in the world, you know, just through the media and the news and newspapers and TV and the internet. And we're so aware, you know, of the magnitude of suffering. You know, it might be racial injustice or religious or political violence, you know, or natural disasters. We're aware of so much. Can we take it in, or does the mind not be able to hold it? You know, and so we retreat into a kind of apathy or indifference. So what happens? Can we take a look at our own responses, our own reactions, you know, of our hearts when we come close to suffering of this kind? Do we feel uneasy? You know, do we withdraw? Do we turn away? Or do we let them in? There was one situation in India where I could see all of these tendencies in my mind, the whole range of response to suffering. And it was a very simple, ordinary experience, but it highlighted all of these conditioned tendencies. Now, again, as most of you know who have been there, there are just an unlimited number of wild dogs who are in the most pitiful conditions. You know, they're not pets, they're not taken care of, they're starving, their coats are full of mange, you know, so many without any fur and sores all over their body. It's so clearly just a condition of such suffering. And they're just there, you know, in the villages and the cities. And so very often I would be in Bodh Gaya, which is where I did a lot of my practice in India. And sometimes, in between times of intensive retreat, I would be going in town and just sitting, you know, in the chai shop, the tea shop, and these dogs would be all around. And it was just so interesting for me to watch my reaction. When I was in a soft and open space, I could really let in the suffering and feel it, you know, and a lot of compassion would arise. You know, and sometimes I'd feed them, and so that would be the response. But I noticed that other times I might be in the tea shop, and either my mind was preoccupied or tired or whatever, and just go away. You know, I just don't want to deal with this, it's too much. I just want to enjoy my tea. Yeah, and there was the whole range that I could see coming up in my mind at different times. So the question for us as we face the magnitude of suffering that is in the world and the part of suffering that's in our own lives, how can our hearts stay open? Is it even possible? You know, can we practice in such a way that we are willing to let it in and to feel it? This challenge is not a theoretical one, because it is really not enough to admire these noble qualities of compassion, of loving kindness. It's not enough to kind of admire these qualities from afar, from a distance. Oh, they are good qualities. And it's not enough also even to practice them in the solitude of a meditation retreat. I mean, here there's a lot of supportive conditions. Yes, may all beings be happy. We think of particular people. May you be happy. May you be free of suffering. But the test is, and the challenge is there a way of transforming our consciousness so that compassionate responsiveness is the default setting of our mind? You know, so we practice it enough so that openness, that compassion comes more and more naturally. This requires a tremendous openness. It requires a lot of mindfulness so that we're aware of what's there. It requires a lot of patience and a lot of equanimity so that we're not overwhelmed by the sorrow, so we're not drowning in the suffering. It's learning simply to be with things as they are, to see things truthfully. And this is the great gift of mindfulness to compassion. Mindfulness gives us this clear vision of what's what. What's the situation here? And with mindfulness, we have that possibility then of opening to the suffering, of feeling it, and responding with compassion. It's really what we're practicing here. Every time you're able to open to and be with some pain or difficulty in your own body or mind, when we can be with it, when we can practice that openness, it's really the practice of compassion. As we learn to be with our own pain, our own difficulty, our own suffering, with an open mind, an open heart, it gives us much greater strength and courage then to be with the suffering of others. There's a Zen teacher in California. His name is Lou Richmond. Some years ago, he suffered a very debilitating disease. It was viral encephalitis, which is a devastating disease and often fatal. Many people die from this. He was in a coma for 2 weeks, and resulting in brain damage and other disabilities. And it took him 3 or 4 years to fully recover from this illness, and he was fortunate that he did. And he wrote a book about this whole ordeal. And he wrote something that just, it really struck me, because it was coming from his own deep experience of this dukkha, of this suffering. He said, "Sometimes when I'm asked to describe the Buddhist teaching, I say this: everything is connected, nothing lasts, you are not alone. This is just a restatement of the traditional three marks of existence: non-self, impermanence, and suffering. I don't think I would have expressed the truth of suffering as you are not alone before my illness. But now I find that talking about it that way gets at something important. The fact that we all suffer means we are all in the same boat. And that's what allows us to feel compassion." I thought that was really a beautiful reframing of his own experience of that tremendous dukkha, realizing that we're all in the same boat, that we are not alone. The beginning of compassion, the beginning of this practice, is the feeling of empathy. And empathy happens, are you familiar with that word? Empathy. Okay. This happens when we take a moment to stop and feel what is going on with another person or with ourselves before rushing on with our lives. Now, this stopping is a challenging practice because often we do know what's going on with the people around us or the people we meet. But how often do we stop, even for a few moments, and actually feel it? Yeah. Feel it in ourselves. That's the quality of empathy. It's not simply knowing intellectually or conceptually, oh, this person is having a hard time. It's just stopping and really letting it in. And it doesn't have to be for hours. It could be just a few moments, but it's that moment of stopping, letting it in, before that onward rush of our lives takes over again. Empathy is this heart mind of inclusion. It takes others in. Most of you are probably familiar with the great Zen master, poet, hermit, Ryokan. He lived at the end of the 18th, beginning of 19th century. And he wrote some wonderful poetry, and they're just delightful stories of his living up in this hut in the mountains, and very poor, you know, with almost nothing, playing with the village children. He had an amazing ability or capacity for inclusion. Just a tremendous sensitivity to the world around him, including even inanimate objects. So this is a short poem he wrote. "I've forgotten my begging bowl, but no one would steal it. No one would steal it. How sad for my begging bowl." I love that. He's just feeling compassion for his poor old begging bowl because no one would want to steal it. We can practice empathy, developing empathy, in different kinds of situations in our lives. It might be opening to the stress of the restless person sitting near to you. You know, instead of our usual reaction of, "Oh, why can't they sit still? They're disturbing my practice." Maybe taking a moment and feeling the dukkha, the suffering, you know, underneath that restlessness. Might be opening and really feeling the difficulties and suffering of people very close to us. Or to a stressful situation in the world. I had a striking example of this. This is quite a few years ago now. But I was at a board meeting, board of directors meeting, of IMS, our meditation center in Massachusetts. And there was a time of a fair degree of conflict. There were a lot of views about, you know, how things should happen. And I remember one particular meeting where, you know, there was a lot of tension in the meeting, and people were holding on quite tightly to their views, myself included. And, of course, we know who had the right view. But that really didn't help the suffering that was there. So at a certain point, I just became aware, I mean, it wasn't hard to do, of the suffering in the meeting. But my mind made a really interesting switch or a little bit of an opening that helped me so much as I was involved in this kind of, you know, conflict of expressing views and opinions. I just, in a moment, I asked myself, well, why does the other person feel it the way they do? You know, what's behind their viewpoint? And what's striking is that it took so long to ask that question. I mean, one would think that that would be an obvious thing to do from the beginning, but it wasn't, at least to me then. And it was amazing. As soon as I could just let go, you know, of my own attachment to view, and just expand, really open that, well, why does the other person feel the way they do about this issue? It was amazing. All of that tension and tightness and conflict, it really disappeared. Then we had a really open discussion about the issue. So, Bankai, who was a 16th century Zen master, in a wonderful book, he's written a book which in English is called The Unborn, and it's a very, I would recommend it if you're interested. But one line in this book kind of summed up this possibility. you know, of opening to other points of view, of opening to the suffering that's there, of developing some empathy for the beings around us. He said, don't side with yourself. You know, don't take your own side. So just to remember that, because how often do we go through life siding with ourselves, right? Taking our own side in every disagreement. So he's saying, don't side with yourself. There might be situations where people really are behaving badly, you know, causing a great deal of harm, either to ourselves or to others. So that's an interesting situation. What does empathy mean then? You know, and how can it be practiced? Yes. I mean, what's our usual reaction when people are causing harm to us? We often get angry or feel ill will or reactive or judgmental about their actions and self-righteous. But is it possible to stop, to see what's going on in a larger context of understanding? And this is possible even in extreme circumstances. Some years ago, I read an article written by Dr. Tenzin Chodrak, who at one time was the physician to the Dalai Lama. This goes back many years. And Dr. Chodrak was imprisoned and tortured by the Chinese government for 17 years. And in the article, he described what made it possible for him not only to survive physically, but to survive with a heart that was still open and not closed in hatred and fear. So this was very interesting. This was coming from somebody in extreme situations, describing how he worked with these practices. First, he said that he saw his torturers, his enemies, as human beings like himself. That his guards and the people tormenting him, he saw them also in adverse situation just as he was, in that they were creating all of that unwholesome karma which would just result in their own future suffering. He never forgot the commonality of our human predicament. As Lou Richman said, we're all in the same boat. He never forgot the truth of this great law of karma, that all actions will have consequences. But what's interesting, even as he framed his situation, this horrible situation, you know, yes, the guards and tormentors were also creating all this unwholesome karma for themselves, so he didn't lose that connection of humanity. But he saw it not as a vehicle of revenge, as one might think, oh, well, they'll get theirs someday. He saw it as a vehicle of compassion, you know, feeling for the suffering that these beings were creating for themselves. So that's quite remarkable. That's a tremendous enlargement of the context of a very difficult experience. It is also important to remember that in situations where it's possible, sometimes it is needed. We do need to take decisive action to stop harmful action, to set appropriate boundaries. But can we do this, even when we're taking appropriately strong action, can we do it with attention to our own motivations? Are we doing it out of hatred? Are we doing it out of anger? Are we doing it out of wisdom? Are we doing it out of compassion? So the motivation in our hearts is up to us. Nobody makes us feel a certain way. That's totally within our own powers. So this is a great realization, not only for these extreme situations, but just in everyday life. How we feel is up to us. I told a little story to the staff group I met yesterday. Years ago, I was in a relationship, and we were having a little argument, and this friend said to me, "Stop making me feel aversion." And I started to laugh. That didn't help. But the thought, somebody makes me feel a certain way, stop making me feel aversion, is so not the truth of the situation. Well, when we can learn that for ourselves, no one makes us feel a certain way, that's up to us. Even, certainly in our ordinary daily life situations, but even in that extreme situation that Dr. Chodrick was describing. This is just from a short biographical sketch, a piece about Tenzin Chodrick. An appearance almost of timidity on first meeting. A voice so quiet it might be a whisper. Dr. Chodrick could easily pass unnoticed until you met his gaze. A gaze filled with the perception of one who has seen so much that he has seen everything, seeing beyond the suffering he has experienced, beyond all the evil and abuses he has witnessed, yet expressing boundless compassion for his fellow human beings. And I just find it inspiring to hold that as a possibility. You know, we may not quite be there yet, but we're also not in that intense situation, most of us. So we can practice just in the daily circumstances of our lives, the times we are in difficult circumstances or with difficult people. Can we be practicing? Can we be practicing that empathy, that connection, that we're all in the same boat and be responding to the suffering that's there with compassion? Aung San Suu Kyi, who, as you know, is the leader of the democracy movement in Burma. She recently had an interview in an Australian newspaper. And as you know, she just this last year, she was released from many years of house arrest. So the reporter asked her, "Don't you want to work to bring the generals down? You know, to topple them from government. Don't you want to bring them down?" And she said, "No, I want to bring them up." I mean, that's quite remarkable, and that's just another example. Can we bring the difficult people in our lives up rather than pull them down? So empathy, this feeling the suffering of others, brings us a step closer to compassion. Compassion takes a further step. It's not only feeling what others feel, but it's also being motivated to act. As compassion grows in us, we begin to take a more active engagement with the suffering in the world, in whatever way seems appropriate and possible. Now, sometimes we act in very small and unnoticed, unregarded ways. It might be simply a small gesture of friendliness in a moment, or generosity, or forgiveness. We shouldn't overlook these small opportunities or underestimate their importance. Again, the Dalai Lama had a wonderful teaching on this. He said, "I try to treat whoever I meet as an old friend. This gives me a genuine feeling of happiness. It is the practice of compassion. That's such a simple idea, isn't it? I try to treat whoever I meet as an old friend. That would just be so striking to begin to practice that. You know, and how that would affect not only our own hearts, but the way we're living in the world. A couple of years ago, I saw a documentary film called A Small Act. Have any of you seen it? It's a very interesting documentary. In the mid-1970s, there was a Swedish woman named Hilda Bach. And she was participating in an international scholarship program sponsored by a group of Swedish nationals. And they were committed to helping children in Kenya continue with their education, you know, when they didn't have enough money to do so. So one of the recipients of this aid was a young boy at the time, Chris Maburo. And for many years, Hilda Bach, just through her small donation, was sponsoring Chris through all the years of primary school and then secondary school and then University of Nairobi. He went on to law school. After law school, he got a Fulbright Fellowship from the States to go to Harvard. He graduated Harvard with a master's degree in international human rights law, went back and was practicing that in Kenya, and after 8 years, he set up his own foundation to help bright kids who came from very impoverished families to continue with their education. And the film is just documenting all this and with interviews. And it's just striking how one quite ordinary, middle-aged Swedish woman, through this small monthly donation, transformed the lives of hundreds and maybe thousands of people. You know, and it was so inspiring to see the power of small acts. You know, and so that's why I just wanted to emphasize that we shouldn't underestimate, right, the power of these acts of compassion. We don't have to be saints or, you know, some special being to be compassionate. Sometimes it is just these very small, simple acts. Sometimes compassion manifests as acts of tremendous determination. You know, it's people with that strong quality of determination in the mind. There's a doctor in the States, his name is Dr. Paul Farmer, and he's done a lot of public health work in very poor countries, first starting in Haiti, and then in many countries around the world, you know, treating AIDS and TB, and quite successful in his work and tremendously inspiring. There's a wonderful book about his work called Mountains Beyond Mountains. And in this book, describing his work in Haiti, they described a clinic that he had set up, you know, in a small town, very busy, lots of people coming. And then at one time, he took off for 2 days to treat a couple of families who lived way out in the country, in the mountains. And his fellow doctors at the clinic criticized him for taking all that time for just, you know, these two families, because so many people were coming to the clinic and he could have helped so many more. This is what he said, and I think it just captures something very beautiful. He said, if you say that 7 hours walk is too long to walk for two families of patients, you're saying that their lives matter less than some others. And the idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that's wrong in the world. That just struck me as being so true. You know, and I think to some extent we all do this in one way or another. And in a way it's natural. You know, that of course the people closest to us we feel more connected with. But can we just drop into that space of understanding that even acknowledging that we have different relationships with people, that no lives matter less than any others? And I think that just resets, you know, how we hold the world and everything that's happening and what needs to be done. So sometimes acts of compassion are just these very small acts. Sometimes they're acts of great determination. Sometimes in acts of great courage. I think Fred mentioned the other night Martin Luther King Jr. You know, and sometimes watching the films of him leading marches in the South and in the North in Chicago, surrounded by people filled with hate. I mean, you can see it on the films. And it's just, it's so amazing to see. And there he is, marching, holding that place of metta, of love. You know, and can just feel the compassion that's there and the strength of that. What is so important as we consider how to develop and strengthen compassion in ourselves and compassionate action that we can take, it's to realize that there is no hierarchy of compassionate action. It's not that some acts are more compassionate than other acts. It has nothing to do with that. The field of compassion is limitless because it is the field of suffering beings. So the opportunity for compassionate response is all around us all the time. And so we each find our own way, you know, depending on what's possible, depending on our interests. It could take the form of an active engagement with the world, where we're really out there, you know, in social action. But compassionate action might also take the form of sitting in a cave in the mountains for 30 years with the motivation that we're working to purify our own hearts for the benefit of others. So just think of the Bodhisattva, you know, the Buddha before his awakening. How many lifetimes must he have been a renunciate, living up, you know, in some cave someplace practicing? And you can just hear, you know, in the mind, imagine what his various families must have been saying. No, what's he doing up there all by himself? He's not helping anybody. You know, he's wasting his time. And yet, motivated by compassion, you know, he spent all of those lifetimes developing the qualities of Buddhahood until that compassionate energy flowered in the world 2,600 years ago. And we're still benefiting from that. You know, we're here today because of all those lifetimes he spent as a renunciate in a cave. So we shouldn't, you know, take too narrow a slice, a vision of what's really compassionate and what's not. Everything rests on the tip of motivation. That's what we need to keep looking at. What's the motivation? Whether we're engaged in the world, whether we're sitting in a cave, is the motivation to alleviate the suffering, our own and others? We need a great deal of humility and a great deal of patience in this cultivation of compassion. Again, from the Dalai Lama, he said, "Changes in attitudes never come easily. The development of love and compassion is a wide, round curve that can be negotiated only slowly, not a sharp corner that can be turned all at once. It comes with daily practice." So I think this is really important to understand, not only in terms of the development of mindfulness, requiring daily practice. Compassion requires daily practice. We need to really have it in the forefront of our attention so we take opportunities to open to the suffering that's there and respond accordingly. Now, it's so easy to idealize compassionate and being a compassionate person and then have some judgment about us not living up to such an ideal. Isa, who was the great Japanese haiku poet, was quite remarkable. He captured something very important when he wrote, "New Year's Day, everything's in blossom. I feel about average." You know, here we are, New Year's Day, everything's in blossom. Aren't we expecting some grand epiphany? No, New Year's Day, everything's in blossom. I feel about average. So can we recognize that in ourselves? Yeah, I feel about average. And I'll take the next step. So we've talked about relative bodhicitta, which is compassion. Ultimate bodhicitta goes beyond the notion of self and other, goes beyond the notion of separation. Ultimate bodhicitta is the empty, aware nature of our mind itself. This is from Jigar Kongchul Rinpoche. He said, "The experience of emptiness, this ultimate bodhicitta, is not found outside the world of ordinary appearance, as many people mistakenly assume. In truth, we experience emptiness when the mind is free of grasping at appearance, at experience." Right? So, you know, we hear ultimate bodhicitta, emptiness, nature of mind. Oh, that's some kind of far off, maybe someday I'll find it. And here Rinpoche is saying it's not outside the world of ordinary appearance. We experience emptiness when the mind is free of grasping. As I said the other night, it's like letting go of the present, coming back to channel zero. So in different traditions of Buddhism, there are different names for this place of freedom in the mind. You know, some traditions call it Buddha nature, or the unborn, or deathless, or nirvana. But they're all pointing to a mind that is free of grasping, free of clinging, free of attachment. So we can't hear that often enough, because no matter how often we do hear it, as we know from our practice, it's so easy to fall into practicing for some experience. You know, we want to feel a little less pain, or we want the calm, or we want the concentration, or we want the experience of emptiness, or whatever, and we're missing the point. The whole point is freeing the mind from grasping at appearance. So this is the move. Not that. So one of the great turning points in my practice, and this was a tremendous shift in how I understood things, was when I was hearing these teachings of bodhicitta, of compassion and emptiness, and realizing that compassion and emptiness of self, are not two different things. In the union of this relative and absolute bodhicitta, we see that compassion is the activity of emptiness. Compassion is the activity of selflessness. So it's not that, like, there's wisdom on one side and compassion on the other and two different things. And this really changed the way I understood the Bodhisattva vows. You know, for those people who take them, you know, I vow to save all beings. Well, I had heard these for years. It just seemed totally impossible. I mean, a beautiful idea, but how could I possibly save all beings? It just seemed impossible. But then I heard these teachings and realized, yes, if we're trying to be compassionate, compassionate for all, to help awaken all, and it's resting on the shoulders of a self, that is impossible. But if we understand compassion as the activity of emptiness, compassion as the activity of selflessness, the more we let go of this strong attachment to self, compassion comes forth quite spontaneously. And so there's an interesting relationship between these two. The more we practice compassion on the relative level, one being to another, the easier it is to recognize the selfless nature. And the more we experience the selfless nature of all phenomena, the empty nature, the more spontaneously does compassion come forth. So they're really elements of each other. I'd like to close with just this short teaching from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who sums up this union of compassion and emptiness. He said, when you recognize the empty, selfless nature of phenomena, when you recognize the empty of self, the empty, selfless nature of phenomena, the energy to bring about the good of others dawns uncontrived and effortless. And that's the great work that we're doing here. You know, as we realize the empty, selfless nature, the energy to bring about the good of others dawns uncontrived and effortless.